Okay.
One question that came up was mic assignments. In Chicago, we had the original board was eight inputs, eight positions, mono. And if I was setting up studio, because we didn't have setup boys, I was one of the setup boys. But in setting it up, part one, mic one, was always the vocal, period. That was the way Bill worked. If I remember correctly, two was bass, mm-hmm. three was piano, mm-hmm. Four was drums, mm-hmm. Five was brass, six was woodwinds, mm-hmm. and...
Seven or eight was strings.
It was strings. Mm-hmm. And then he had an interesting thing, which was repeated on a Capitol album. Since the tape machine came back into the console, the last fader on the board was tape reverb. And on mono, it's easy. On stereo, it doesn't work very well. But he would bring some of the input. Remember, we're dealing with three-track machines, erase, record, playback, and at 15 IPS, there was quarter of a second delay. And so, depending upon the material, he would bring up the tape reverb pot, and so that would be, shall we say, feedback coming into the board just slightly later. And on certain strings, things particularly, it would be very effective. And Capitol made use of that.
Especially the pizzicato strings.
Yes. And it would be a very nice delay effect, not echo, really. Yeah. And if you went too far, it would take off. Yes, exactly.
Right there?
Yep. And, but when stereo came along, it didn't work as well, but it was still, I think it's you still used occasionally, perchance.
But then they had mechanical stuff that came along that they used for that purpose. And
yes.
A separate tape machine with a separate movable head on it and so on. That was more of a gimmick than anything else, and it really didn't get used all that much.
No, but it was a nice effect.
Yeah. Echoplex.
Yeah, Echoplex, right. And Bill always, for as long as I knew him, he liked to have, and he started it with this in Chicago, his microphones all had Hubble twist-lock connectors on them. No Canon three pins, but Hubble twist locks.
Three pin
twist locks.
What kind of microphones are we talking?
All kinds of microphones. Had three pin twist locks on. For as far as he was concerned, that was it. You know, and
why?
Well, because when you put them in, you twisted them and they locked in place. So some musician comes tripping through the studio and trips over a cord and didn't yank it out, number one.
No, it tore it off.
Yeah, well, if he hit it hard enough, it did, yeah. But, and the other thing was that he contended that and you, when you twisted it in, it wiped the contacts clean, and so you didn't have a noisy connection. But, like all things, that had to go sooner or later, you know. But he did carry it on to Los Angeles. When he came from Chicago to Los Angeles, he did. All the mic input boxes had the twist lock Hubbles in them, and they weren't cheap. They were expensive. Some of them, I think they cost at least twice what the Canons cost. But it got to the point where when we were big enough and we needed more microphones on occasion, we'd have to borrow some from another studio in town. And of course there were places in town where you could actually rent recording equipment.
Audio rents,
yeah, and Charlie Washburn and yep. Those guys. You get a piece of gear from them, and they always came with a Canon on them. So we had to make up pigtails with a Canon to Hubble connectors, you know. That got out of hand, too. So we decided that, no, maybe that's not such a good idea after all. And he decided that the maintenance department was going to go through and change all the panels over to Canons. Well, the holes were about that big around so that meant changing the entire panel door or putting a cover plate over it, which is what we ended up finally doing. I think we put a shim, not a shim, but a, a, a panel over the same size as the thin aluminum over the thing, glued it in place, and cut the small hole for the cannons to go in. And it took quite a while, as you may imagine. We had Studio A had at least 4 microphone input panels in there, and Studio B had at least 3.
Yeah. Right.
And they all had at least 16 inputs on them, right?
Yes.
I think so, yeah. So it was a lot of work.
And they were all in parallel.
Oh,
so
yeah. Oh, yeah, they were all parallel.
You didn't plug into one there, otherwise you'd be very confused.
Yeah, they were all looped.
Looped together, yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing Bill did occasionally, and this was, I don't know if anybody else does that, but this he built up boxes that would put the 2 microphones in series. And so he would have like 277s, and he'd plug them in there, and then plug in, there were in series, and then he'd plug that in the wall, and that gave him like 2 mics over the strings, and he didn't have to, you know, he didn't have enough pots, because otherwise he ran out of pots, especially on a big orchestra. So... He would do that, and he also had some that were parallel. And it would depend on what microphone he was using as to which one he would use, whether it would be series or parallel. And he, in fact, actually had some series parallel ones that he used on string sections and some things where he needed 3 or 4 microphones on this particular section. More than occasionally, we had large orchestras in there. Nowadays, that's a thing of the past, as far as I know, except in the scoring stages. Scoring stages still have big bands in there. But in the average recording studio around town, most of them kind of dwindled down to the point there. The managers decided, we don't need all this space for bands anymore because nobody's recording big orchestras anymore or big bands. So they started cutting them down and putting up partitions and making individual little recording studios out of them to get more business and to cater to the groups that only needed a small room for voiceovers or whatever, you know. So, yeah.
I don't know if there's ever a good time to ask this, so it might as well be now. When I was 18, which would be about 73, mm-hmm. I went to Western.
Uh-huh.
I actually went out from Indiana. I went to L.A. for 2 weeks and hightailed it back. I was not ready for L.A. at 18. But
that's surprising.
I know, it's true. It worked out. I remember that the monitors were behind the console. Is my memory
in Western?
Totally wrong?
Yeah. The only place that could have been was probably in Studio 2 in the back.
I walked in and was like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, well, it was for a quad recording.
Was it?
Oh, yeah. There was 3 in the front, too, right?
I don't remember.
Oh, well, I'm sure there were. We had 3 of them across the front and 2 in the back.
And the 3 in the front were over the window.
Yeah, they were over above the control room window. On all of our studios, the speakers were above the control room windows.
It's funny, my mind erased the ones in the front, and yeah. I just saw the ones in the back. That's awesome.
Yeah, that was something that Bill started doing when he moved to L.A., because up to that point, all of the studios were set up for monaural in Chicago. And that studio did a lot of advertising spots and whatever, you know, and they didn't need anything but mono anyway. Mm-hmm. And what little stereo we did do was just before he, a very short time before he moved from Chicago to Los Angeles. And there we did some stereo, which we called crossover stereo, and that was where we used we mic'd the studio in the normal manner, split up on the board the left and right, and then put up additional microphones above the sections up quite a ways away, not tight mic'd. And we had a piece of board with a couple of plug-in preamps on it that were sitting in the studio, and we plugged the mics in there and fed tie lines back to a line level, back to a mixer in another room in the back end of the building. And in there we had, the guy had two 620 monitors hanging on the wall and a console with six pots on it and a master fader in the center. And
Ampeg 620, somebody doesn't know them.
Oh, the 620 Ampeg 620 speaker systems. They were electrified, amplified speakers.
Ampeg or Altec?
Ampex.
Nope. Ampex.
They were a matching component to go with the 600 tech deck. A little leather case. They're about so big.
Looked like a small Samsonite suitcase.
Yes, that's right. They did.
And they were.
Oh, they were. They were good. They were good.
They really were made by Samsonite.
Yeah.
Yes.
So anyway, there was a separate mixer for the stereo. The mixer, which was usually Bill, in the main control room, did a mono mix, through a combining coil, did the combining of the left and right channels, and the outboard mics, we call them outboard mics, were fed directly to the back room and did not go through the mix in the board. They were used to augment the sound of the left and right and cross them across. In other words, an instrument on the left side, we'd have the overall on the right side, and we had just enough of it to get some room ambience in it. And we did quite a few that way, yes?
So what are some of the highlights of, what was the most fun for you? What were your highlights, of your highlights?
I had fun every day, I really did. I think what I enjoyed the most was the challenge of the new things that we did, and the things that we kind of pioneered. Bill did a lot of pioneering as far as studio setup goes. He had things set in his mind the way he thought things should be, and he would making a brass section. He would put the trumpets and trumpets on the top row of a riser, using a couple of 77s maybe, for four guys, two 77s up there, DX 77 DXs, and then he would put a 44 BX right down in front of him with four trombone players, edgewise to the trumpet, so you pretty much get rid of the now that's bidirectional, so you don't have any pickup off the ends. Supposedly, I've always had a little, but it was very much directional to the sides, and you had your trombones working that thing right in close proximity to the brass, to the trumpets. So there was a good tight brass feeling on the thing, and yet we didn't have a lot of crosstalk between the two, so we could adjust the channel levels a little better, things like that. He did that all the time, stuff like that. He would take the, sometimes he would put, if there weren't as many, he would put trumpets and trombones on the same riser, and he'd put woodwinds down there with a 44 BX in the middle, it really paid off, and it was a,
Were you familiar with the Wrecking Crew?
No, I don't think so.
Tommy Tedesco and...
Tommy Tedesco, I know,
Yeah, there's a movie from his son made.
Oh.
That's all about the L.A. scene in that time.
I heard about that, but I haven't seen it.
So what bands could you list that we might have heard of?
That he worked with?
That you've worked with, yeah.
Well, Nelson Riddle and
Stan Kenton.
Yeah, Stan Kenton. Stan Kenton, sure.
And, Duke Ellington.
He was one of my favorites, Stan Kenton. And who?
Duke Ellington.
Yeah, Duke Ellington and Basie. And let's see, Nelson Riddle, I said. What was the other one?
Newfangled bands, maybe?
No, newfangled bands? No, I don't think so. Not while I was there, anyway. He was good friends with all these guys. you know, they had worked with him in Chicago making records as well. So, you know, he knew them, and they asked for him. And, of course, he always obliged by doing the job for them, you know. I was talking to Mike last night about the one thing we were talking about. The guy at the Hollywood Bowl,
Felix Slotkin.
Felix Slotkin. And
whose son is Leonard Slotkin, St. Louis Symphony.
Right.
And National Symphony. And
his wife is Eleanor. Is one of the fabulous cellists. Around.
Was, unfortunately.
And And the thing about it was that I was a recordist on the session that Bill was doing for Liberty Records. It was an album called Street Scene, and all the tunes had a street in the name. You know, Street of Dreams and On the Street Where You Live. But we got through the first session. There's always two sessions to an album. You know, they get one side and then they get the other side. And sometimes three sessions. But anyway, we got the whole session done, and we played back the stuff, and everybody liked it. And everybody went home, and the next session was scheduled for the next day. And I got the call that come in that Bill wasn't going to come in. Nobody said why. So I came in, and they wanted me to finish the session, to mix the rest of the date. And I thought, well, that's kind of strange, you know, what's the deal? Well, as it turns out, Felix had died the night before. And Bill was so broken up about it, he just couldn't do it. So I had to finish the sessions, and that was a somber session, to say the least, with all those guys in here. Yeah. But we did all the big bands that were around during that day, and all the different labels. You know, we did stuff for practically all the labels, except we didn't do too much for Capitol or Columbia because they had their own studios. But all of the independents, like Liberty and Chess and those people.
What were the years that bookended this?
I'm sorry?
What were the years that bookended this?
Oh, beginning 50s to the end of the 60s, the beginning 70s, yeah.
So would like the Beach Boys were coming in?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
That's what I'm asking about, these kinds of newfangled bands.
Yeah.
Beach Boys worked in Studio 3 at Western.
Yeah.
Which was, you went down the hall and to the right, and it was an icebox door, a large icebox door. And once they were in there, they were separated from the world.
They started out in Studio B at United.
Yeah.
With the Bones Howe, as I recall.
Yes.
And they then moved into 3 when we got it finished. I don't know whether it was because the other studio was busy at the time or what, but for whatever reason, and once they heard Studio 3, that was it. They wouldn't work anywhere else in there for that. Bones. I don't know if I'm sure heard of Bones Howe. He was an on-staff mixer for a while at our place, and then went off and did freelance work after that. And he did, what was up and away? What was his group was in?
The Fifth Dimension.
Aretha Franklin.
That was done in Studio 3 at Western, too. And we had studios also in San Francisco and in Las Vegas. And part of my job was to make sure that the stuff kept going. I mean, I was at that time head of maintenance and later chief engineer. And then later than that, I was vice president of engineering. And at that point, I was doing very little in the way of actual studio work anymore. I still did some remote work. I kind of liked remote stuff. And I liked, as I told Mike, I really, really loved to do cartoon recordings, the cartoon sound music tracks, because they were so frantic, you know. people are just you know, running around like chickens, you know, on the stage, you know, trying to pick up enough equipment to play. You know, the guys that come in, the horns. I mean, we had usually two or three French horns, but the woodwind guys would come in, and in L.A. the woodwind guys all played any kind of woodwind, anything with a reed in it, they played it. It didn't matter, you know.
Or a flute.
Or a flute, yeah, flutes too. Flutes, piccolo, anything like that. And they brought all that stuff with them. Boy, and these, those guys would sit there with the stands that they have in front of them and all around them, and they'd have all kinds of stuff, everything from baritone sax to oboes, you know. And they'd be picking up one, blown three notes, and setting it down and grabbing another and playing three notes and setting it down. And the percussion guys are running back and forth in the back there, you know, between the timpani and the xylophones and the whatever, you know. It's really frantic.
What cartoons? Like Leon Fleischer or Looney Tunes? Or
yeah,
what?
Yeah.
Carl Stalling?
Yeah.
Carl Stalling?
And a lot of Hanna-Barbera.
Really?
Yeah, I did a whole bunch of Hanna-Barbera stuff. And I did a couple of full-length features for Hanna-Barbera. I did both the narration recording and the music tracks for them.
Which?
Hey There, Yogi Bear, and Our Man Flintstone was another one.
Do you want to mention about musicians, or shall I?
Go ahead.
What was always fascinating, the contractor would have been called by the record company, and we're going to be doing a date on this date, and here's the instrumentation, and they might say, well, I want so-and-so for first chair here, but the contractor would select and organize the musicians, and they'd come in, and let's say it was a 2 o'clock downbeat. That meant at 2 o'clock, you had to be ready to play.
Oh, yeah.
And the copyist would hand out the parts, and the musicians would noodle through the part, and he'd say, okay, 2 o'clock, let's run through it. And you'd listen to it, and you'd say, oh, let's record it and go home. Because these guys could sight read without even trying. And I can remember somebody saying, well, in the second bar before B, second measure, is that a B flat or a B sharp? Because the copyist made a mistake. And they heard it and said, oh, that's not right. And they'd do it.
Yeah.
And these guys were professional. They'd be doing a gig at United from 2 to 5, and they might be doing a date at Capitol from 7:30 to 10:30.
Radio recorders or someplace else, yeah.
But they were professional. They made very good money.
Yeah, so basically you're just alluding to it. So back then it was pretty much just 3-hour sessions, that's it.
No? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Local AFM, local 47. They controlled recording, and we were allowed 15 minutes of recorded music in a 3-hour session.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. And if the conductor was not paying attention and it was 5 o'clock, that was it, unless he was willing to pay overtime. And they would insist on it. But again, it was fixed sessions. And if you were a non-union musician, you practically didn't play. Again, these were guys were regular, and so you'd see people come in, and you'd know by the person who was Justin Gordon, who was tenor sax. You know, if he came in, there'd be other people with him because that's who the contractor liked.
Yeah.
But professional musicians.
Yeah, Bob talked about the 35 millimeter very briefly, and that was the Stansel Hoffman that he had, that we got. And it took a while. We did get the wow out of it, but it took a while. In the meantime, we had booked a session, and I think it was for Herman Klebanoff, as I recall.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. And it was on for 35 millimeter. You know, that was when that big craze hit that everybody wanted to go 35
that
millimeter.
Magnetic tape or is that film?
Magnetic film.
Magnetic
sprocketed film.
Full coat.
Full
coat.
Yeah, full coat.
So
yeah, full coat or stripe. I mean, it was, anyway, I went next door. We had a company that was in our same building, that shared space in our building. And it was a film dubbing operation. And they had a Westrex 35 millimeter three-stripe machine on a roll-around cart. The machine is about this wide and about that high and about that deep and probably weighed 250, 300 pounds, you know. So, fortunately, it was on a roll-around table. And we knew the people very well, we traded stuff back and forth all the time. And so I went in there and I got the guy. The guy's name was Larry Eicholtz, and it was Hollywood Sound Recorders. And he let me use this Westrex. So we rolled it over, we rolled it in the control room. Well, it became very apparent quickly that thing was making so much noise you couldn't hear the mix, you know. So, I mean, the sprockets are picking and the whole thing is running away, you know. So we thought, whoa, you know. So we took it and moved it into the dub down room and patched the whole thing up by tie line. And so then we're sitting there with a telephone okay, roll it now, you know, and just start this thing up in the other room and start recording again. But it was about that time that we decided we wanted to get more into the recording of film and to actually do video, not take video, but I mean to do TV stuff. And we did a whole season of Gunsmoke directly from the studio directly onto 35mm film. And we did that in Western One. That was the big studio at Western. And I had to do some talking to get Bill to go with the film thing. Before we left Chicago, we had put in a film dubbing studio. Bill didn't know too much about it. He knew we were doing it, but one of the other guys wanted it. And so he said, "Oh, go ahead. We got the space. Go ahead and do it." You know, but he wasn't all that thrilled with it. But I was able to con him and Tony Perry, who had the money, and was doling it out, that we needed to have some dummies and recorders. I bought a used RCA. Telecine machine, 16mm Telecine machine. Never heard anything louder than that when you heard that thing run. It had a big fan in the back for shutter, and it just was the noisiest thing I'd ever seen. And so we had closed the door on the studio on the back on the dubbing room there where we had it mounted because it was you could hear it all the way up the other end of the building when it was running. And so the idea was to transfer the 16mm work print over to videotape. Do the session playing back playing the videotape to the studio. Well, the reason for that was that up to that point we were running a big 35mm studio motion picture house type projector, and you had to darken the room. Projected on a screen. You had to have lights on all the music stands, you know. It was a pain because, you know, to do that for one group of things and then have another session come in after that and have to clean up all of those lights and cables and headphone cables for everybody, it was just crazy. And so the traffic people said, "Nah, it's taking too long. We got to have the studio," you know. So we did the video thing, and I put up a 21-inch monitor on a stand in front of a conductor's podium. Musicians don't have to see that stuff with the streamers going by. That's the conductor needs that, and they're listening to click tracks anyway, so you know they don't have to have that. So I put the screen there for him, and I put another one for the percussion people because they did you know things where they needed to hear what you know see where things had to hit. But that was it, and we ran a 1-inch. Ampex videotape machine, monaural, but it had two tracks on it, but one of them was a control track. And I would record the control track on one track of a multi-track machine, and then we would record multi-track, but we'd take a mono mix and put it on the one track of the of the videotape machine. CellSync it on. Fortunately, it had that facility available to get CellSync on it. And so we'd play the tape. They'd do the recording. We'd zip it back, rewind it that fast, about one-tenth of the time that it takes to reset a set of dummies and 35-millimeter stuff. And we play it back right away with the mono mix right off the tape out to the studio. They heard what they did. They could see what they did, and everything. Everybody was happy. And they liked it so much that we got a lot of business with it.
That's so great. I got to interrupt you here because our time is running out. Can we take maybe one more question? Does anybody else have something they want to ask before we... Jay?
Yeah.
Jay had a question.
Sort of getting back to the technical aspect of things and sound in the studios, this is kind of a weird question, but so a lot of the equipment of yesteryear, is some like old Neve consoles, things with transformers. A good example is like the 610 modules.
Mm-hmm.
They do this thing to the sound where it's like putting a magnifying glass on the low end of things, and the low frequencies get a little bit larger than life.
Well, some of that has
something that happened in United and Western. Is that something that you experienced then? Is it something that was designed?
No, they were pretty.
Way 600 ohm.
They were pretty flat, but they had the preamps had 50 ohm inputs on them, and we used those with the microphones. If you don't have a mic that's terminated like that with 50 ohms, it can change the response on the low end in particular.
May I slightly correct you on that?
Yeah, sure.
If I may. I recall somewhere about 55, we got in Chicago a recording of Gail Storm, who was a female artist, and she had sibilance that really killed you. And it turns out they came from Capitol and they had used a U-47.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the practice was at that time, and it was with us, if the microphone was a 50 ohm or 150 ohm, it was terminated in 150 ohms, matched impedance. Yeah. But Neumann, the German manufacturers, were expecting a load impedance of five times at least the source impedance. So if it was a 150 ohm mic, they were expecting the input of the mic input,
Bridget,
transformer
yeah.
probably, to be at least 750 ohms. So it was in effect bridging, which is still the practice. But we had to use pads to knock them down, and then it was Steve Timmer who started Gotham Audio and was importing legally the U-47s, and he read the German instructions, and they talked about this 1-to-5 ratio. So since then, the microphone manufacturers end up with non-terminated inputs. Terminating it 50 ohms to 50 ohms is maximum power transfer. But for a microphone, you aren't concerned about power. You only want a certain amount of voltage appearing. Even Ohm's Law talks about that.
So you generally, like on the 610 modules, you had them switched down to what, 150 or 50 ohms?
Somewhere down there. But
yeah,
again, the actual input was closer to 750 ohms, maybe even 1K,
right.
If you actually measured it.
Okay, but the microphones at that point were maybe closer to 150 or 150 ohms as opposed to what they are today.
Well, I don't know what they are today. I don't think they changed it that much, do they?
No.
Mike?
150.
150.
Yeah. And it's almost a number. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
It's a point of voltage transfer.
Anything else anywhere?
Last question.
Not particularly relevant to anything we've already talked about, but from the Chicago history, I was kind of curious where Murray Allen came from. Was he part of the team, or was he like a buyer that stepped up later?
Murray Allen was one of the original partners in the in the Bill and Paul Weber, I mean, and Weber and no?
No, the original.
Oh, no, I take it back. I take it back. Murray bought into the company when Bill left.
Yes.
Yeah, right. That's what it was. Uh-huh.
And that was.
He was one of the owners.
That was 58, late 58?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because Bill's original partners were Bill Putnam, Bernie Clapper, and Bob Weber.
Right.
And they all had three separate functions. Bob did most of the mastering. Bernie did most of the agency dates,
yeah.
Which Bill hated with a passion.
Yeah.
Oh, if you wanted him to do an agency date, yuck, he hated it. Because the producers, that's put more stress on that word, dog. And he hated that because he wanted to help produce something.
Yeah. Yeah, he liked to be productive when it came to helping to provide guidance during a recording session. And he helped by giving suggestions and what have you to the artists and to the directors and A&R people.
And on that, we need to wrap it up here. Thank you very much,
okay.
Bob and Jerry.
We got a couple of minutes while Rick packs up. I brought along a picture book of consoles that my company later on built because Bill decided to get out of the custom console business because it was very labor-intensive and not high profit. So I started Bushnell Electronics, and I've got a number of pictures of boards built in the through the 70s. So you might be interested in seeing what was common back then.
If you want to get a real quick picture,
okay.
You guys...